It is so good to see you all. Welcome to Creating the Future's Integrity Team meeting for the first meeting of January 2025. And 2025 is already starting out to be for so many people. So I'm really glad that we are all together. We are starting something new today, which is overdue and we are excited about, which is why Dimitri is checking it out. We have finally moved away from Twitter. So that is joyful. We have migrated anybody who is going to be watching the live stream and commenting is going to be doing so at YouTube. And so we are just keeping fingers crossed that all of the testing and testing and testing that we've done is working. So if you are watching at YouTube, please comment so that we can know it's working. Even if it's just to say hello. It is wonderful to see you all, and we've got a bunch of things to be talking about because life is like that these days. Let's start with just sort of going around and telling everybody who you are, where you are, whose lands you are on, and if you know something about the people rather than just the land, that would be awesome. And something that is meaningful in your life these days. Who wants to kick us off?
I can start us off. I'm Justin Pollock. I am on land, which is at the confluence of the Potomac and the Anacostia River, also known as Washington, D.C., and formerly stewarded by the Nacotchtank and Skattawich and many tribes, because there was a lot of overlap and such in this area. We have snow on the ground, which is not always something that's happening here, so that's nice. Let's see. So my highlight, this is my first Zoom of 2025. So I made it 13 days without having to have a meeting where I was on Zoom. So I'm still adjusting everything because the other piece that goes along with that, so this is more of a personal professional piece, is I'm trying to catch up with Lou and write some more. And Now, I've had an opportunity to sort of sit back and reflect and take some of the pieces that I've been developing through my own practice, which is really values-driven integrity work around organizational design. And I've had enough people sort of push me to say, you need to write about that stuff and try and help expand on some of that. So that's what I'm doing.
That's exciting. I am looking forward to that. And Vu's quite a standard to hold yourself to in terms of writing schedule. In addition to blogging every week in a way that makes us all pay attention, you're also working on a book right now, aren't you, Mr. Lay? Yeah.
As are you, Hildy, so let's not forget
That's
that. So.
true. That's true. And it's a pain, I will tell you. It is both joyful and we'll call it fun. We'll leave it at that. We'll leave it at that. There's words that are not ready for prime time, and we'll just leave it at fun. Who else? What's going on in your world?
I'll go ahead. My name is Shantine, and most of you I have met before. I'm very happy to be here again with you all. Also, my first 2025 Zoom meeting. Very exciting. I am in Northern California. I'm on the Ohlone lands up here, and I'm an attorney. I'm working on, I have my own law firm, but I'm working on some other projects right now, so I'm very excited. But my most meaningful thing, I think, is more of a reflection upon what's been happening in Los Angeles, my hometown, and my best friend and Hildy's daughter is also there. I'm just worried about the folks there. Grateful that on one hand, my family is safe, and that's the best we can hope for. But of course, it's been very devastating to see what's been happening to my hometown and places that I hold very near and dear. So I just sending all the love and positivity and luck and everything I can to the people who are there trying to work through their recovery. Yeah, it's just, I'm sure we've all seen the news, and it's been just such an incredible and devastating thing to behold. So I'm just happy to be here safe and sound with you all. And this is reminds us to take things to never take things for granted, rather. So yeah, happy 2025 though otherwise. And like, this is a good way to start. This is a very good way to start out.
Yeah, I think it's heavy on all of our minds. All of our minds. Thank you. Who wants to go next? Yeah, Carl.
Hi everyone, I'm Carl. I'm based out of a place called St Albans, about 20 miles north of London, in the UK. So of course we are. I don't have any land acknowledgement for you, I'm afraid. It's sort of almost sort of following on from sort of Shantaine. You know, I mean, my sort of awesome, I guess, is that it's sort of nice to be alive, isn't it? And sort of like to be safe and sort of so on, because it feels like it's quite a sort of tense and sort of dangerous world at the minute. But a small personal awesome is that we have a movement in the UK called Parkrun, where if you haven't heard of that, every Saturday, whichever town you live in, people come together and they go for a 5K or what, 3.5 miles run around the local green space. And for very sort of boring, mundane reasons, I used to volunteer there before and I stopped volunteering. I sort of just fell out of it for a bit and so on. But plus sort of Christmas, I've started volunteering again. So my awesome is that, you know, I mean, it's a very simple thing. You stand there, you marshal at the side, and people run past you and they just say, "Hey, thanks, Marshall, for volunteering." And I tell you guys, it's just the most fucking awesome feeling ever. I mean, it really is. I mean, we complicate a lot of stuff about impact and outcomes and sort of stuff, but so much of it is just about that sort of human connection. And even though it was -3 on Saturday and I had to stand there for 1.5 hours and my feet were freezing, I absolutely loved it.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. It sounds wonderful. Thank you. Who's up next?
I'll go.
Yay.
My name is John Epps. I'm in on the land of the Yamava peoples in the San Bernardino area. We are currently fire free, so we're hoping we stay that way. But there's some concern. The winds are picking back up. I am very excited to be in 2025 with you all. Looking forward to more of the kind of human experiences that Carl just talked about. And I think for me, just trying to figure out how to stay in a state of joy throughout the year. So that's my hit for 2025.
That's a big one. That's a big one. Thank you, John. Who wants to go next?
I'll go. Can you hear me okay? Hi, everyone. Angie Eikenberry. I'm in Hartford, Connecticut, which is the land of many different tribes, the Eastern Pequot, the Golden Hill Paugusett, the Lenape, the Montaukett Pequot, Mohegan, Nipmuc, and the Gatakoke. I'm learning about this area because I just moved here not long ago. Still getting to know the area. It's pretty awesome to be in here and learning about the history and all the things that come with being in a more dense area in the eastern part of the country. And that's, I guess, part of my awesome. It's like every day learning new things as I live here. To Carl's point and John's point, just even like going up and down the elevator in my building and having discussions with folks about what they're doing and how they're living their lives has been a joy. and walking to campus and interacting with people and try to embrace that as much as possible, but still try to focus on the energy of resistance also. Good to see everybody.
Yeah. And back in November, we got to see Angie in Hartford, which was delightful. Kim, what's going on in your world?
So much, always so much, right? I'm Kim Chung. I'm the executive director at the Center for Family Literacy in Edmonton, which is on the traditional lands of Treaty 6 and Métis territory of the North Saskatchewan River. And the Indigenous peoples that came before us were the Cree, Blackfoot, Nakota Sioux, Iroquois, Dene, Ojibwe, Salto, Anishinaabe, and Inuit in this area. So recognize doing lots of learning with many of those groups and their elders. Lots of initiatives happening in Edmonton right now, which are amazing in reconciliation and all of that. So we are participating in as much as we can to do our part for reconciliation. We've just been really busy. Like we've I think if you've read Hildy's summary, she talked, I didn't know I was in there, but I'm in there. We're doing a lot of catalytic thinking with our community impact planning and everything moving forward, which has been a very different approach than we've had in the past. And I was telling, I think last time we met Hildy, I was going from yes to oh my goodness, what are we doing? Like within minutes, I still am very much on the yes side, but we keep having a lot of things pop up that are just kind of impeding personally, work, and politically, of course. So there's just lots of stuff going on, lots of things to work through, and trying to keep it at a level where I'm still using catalytic thinking as a process, and making sure I'm doing it that way has been a challenge, but it'll be fine. We'll get there. So thanks for inviting me to this. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you here. Wonderful. Yeah, Mark, welcome.
Yeah, glad to be back. Thank you. I've been away for a while, but I realized, I used to admire everybody here for their knowledge of where they are and everything else. We've only got one tribe left, and that's the Shinnecock here out of 12 families that were here, part of the Iroquois Nation. Another story for another day. And we're not using their knowledge well enough. We have a lot to learn, and I don't think we're doing it yet. But getting through the colonial imprint right now in our town. And what really drew me to this conversation today was the idea of resisting tyranny, and we've got it in our town, and it's just so embedded and so assumed. So we've been using the principles of catalytic thinking and listening for several years now, and it's starting to become embedded in people's approach, if you will. So I'm doing social behavior tools for behavior change in a social setting, and it's expanded beyond just food scraps. It's gone to community organizing and citizens' assemblies and more. Thank you.
It's always inspiring listening to what you're doing, Mark. Always inspiring. Vu, how about you? You awake enough to say hello this morning?
Good morning, everyone. It's Vu. I'm calling in from Seattle, which is on Duwamish and Coast Salish land. I've actually been up since 6 a.m. I've just been, this is my writing mode where I'm wrapped in a blanket in front of on the couch where I'll be spending the next 10 hours just writing on this book. I think my awesome is that I've been learning to embrace mediocrity. I feel like with this president that's coming back, who is just the most horrible person. There should be like an end to any sort of imposter syndrome any of us ever feel again. And so I was just thinking about my book, and I was like, oh God, this book is so blah. It's just not the same standard. And I'm just thinking, you know what? If this asshole can become president again, then I think my book is fine. It's not gonna be great. It might be C plus. That's fine. Whatever. I don't care. That's my awesome.
A C plus with you is worth a read. I'm good. I'm totally good. Dimitri, how about you? I will
Actually, thinking about what you just said, Vu, and a couple of the other comments, it's you almost need something as a palate cleanser in our current reality. And I actually have two awesomes. I'll be as quick as I can. And if it's Mount Lemon, I don't want to take yours, Hildy. Okay. We took a trip up to Mount Lemon, which is a pine forest that's about 30 miles from where we live. So you go from the desert to the pine forest. And there was a young man who was a citizen scientist who had set up a telescope, and he was looking at the sun and just invited people just come up and take a look. And so it was just amazing to on a Sunday afternoon, totally unexpected, to come across this young man and his generosity in sharing this. I don't know how expensive all this equipment was that he'd set up, but to be able to do that. So it was just really awesome to find people who are just being real about what they believe in, aren't part of any kind of institution or college or whatever, just doing it on their own and happily sharing it with people around them. The other quick awesome is we visited through Zoom our granddaughter yesterday, and she is on the iPad and we talk and she knows, it's just kind of fun having her be so conscious of who we are and that we call every Sunday and we were there. She put the iPad on the little baby stroller and took us all around the house. Where do you want to go next? And she would take us into this room, and where do you want to go next? And she would take us to the kitchen, and she would sort of narrate this a tour of their house. And it was just totally awesome to be interacting with a young, new, fresh human being who is just being loving and sharing and fun. So that's my awesomes for today. Oh, and Tucson, Arizona, home of the Tohono O'odham and the Pascua-Yaqui, the unceded lands of those people. So didn't want to leave that out.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, those things were absolutely delightful. Absolutely delightful. First of all, I want to mention, I know that we've mentioned this in the past, but I will mention it again. If you need a good palate cleanser, and I know, Shantine, I know, Carl, you know this one, Taskmaster. Yeah, if you need the kind of cleansing that can only come from laughing so hard you are oozing out of every orifice, it is the only thing that is saving me. It is Taskmaster. It's on YouTube. There's a million different seasons of it, and yeah, it is our necessary medicine these days is just to laugh. Kim, I know you're another fan. Another fan. Slow horses is good, buddy. You're not laughing your buns off. And these days, I need to laugh my buns off. Carl, you are making me think about your volunteering stuff, which just makes me smile. It is making me think about we released our latest podcast just this morning. And the woman, first of all, Yodit is just brilliant. So I'll start with the fact that she's brilliant and wise, and but everybody I interview get is so that's pretty fun. She talks about what is going on in Rwanda after the genocide, and it reminded me so much of what you're talking about, Carl, that every last Saturday of the month, the country closes down for 3 hours, and everyone between the ages of 18 and 65 is required to do community service. So, as a way of bringing the country back together after the horrific incidents that happened in the 90s, that is what they're doing. And literally, it shuts down for 3 hours. People clean. She said Rwanda is the cleanest place you can imagine, because they're cleaning, they're weeding, they're helping neighbors. They're, it really makes me think about what does it look like when we incorporate that, as she phrases it, collective care into policy. Which really just really touched me, and you made me think of that, Carl. And so if you're not subscribed to our podcast, you need to start subscribing now. mostly what's going on in my world is clicking refresh on Fire Maps. And I know that many of you are doing the same. Those of us who have loved ones in LA, we've got two of our kids are in LA. They are safe. A dear friend of Lizzie's has lost absolutely everything. She and her 3-year-old were out of the country on vacation and came back to literally nothing. No underwear, no socks, no toys for the baby, no nothing. They came back to nothing. And so many people are in that situation. And so that's really what it puts a different spin on the word awesome. I mean, it is filled with the kind of awe we don't want to be experiencing, but will be more and more. And it is so important that we're all doing the work that we're doing. So I'm deeply grateful to all of you. And so many of us have experienced fires. Kim, I know you've experienced fires in the past year. We were back east in November, and there were fires in New Jersey. That's ridiculous. That's doesn't happen. We wanted to spend a lot of time in Brooklyn, and Prospect Park was on fire. So, I mean, we really need to be dealing with the fact that the world has changed. And it's a big part of what we're going to be talking about today. So thank you all for being here. And Dimitri, are we working on
We're working.
we're up and live?
I just did a test chat or comment, and it popped up. It says that there's four concurrent viewers. So one
All
of them
right.
is
One
me.
of them's you. Well, that's working. I will tell you all, it has been a priority for us to get away from Twitter for a long time, and it just feels really good to have made that move. So let's dive in. I guess that probably what I would like to do, I'd like to just know anybody's thoughts on what you read in terms of let's start with, just a quick review of 2024. There's nothing we can do about the past, and so I just want to do a quick review of what stood out to you as you were looking at what we did in 24. What stands out to you about where we're headed in 25? And let's just do a brief sort of overview of the past year and the coming year. What is standing out to you from what you saw in what we sent out?
I'll start by saying, just amazing amount of work that you've done, and in a very efficient, low cost way. But the resource list was just amazing, like bringing that all together, what's there and what we could build on and what opportunities are was pretty exciting to see.
Yeah, it was incredible to do both of those, actually to list the accomplishments of 24, and then to list all the re the, listing the resources. I'm going to say took me a week to find, and I'm sure it's not complete. I'm sure it's not complete. When Rebecca was working with us years ago, Rebecca thought that a big part of her job was to say, you've already written that. You know that already exists. She had like the library in her head. And so I'm sure we'll keep finding more. But looking at that list of 2024 accomplishments, Dimitri and I looked at each other and went, no wonder we're tired. What else is standing out? What else? Ahad for you as you were looking at it. What else is standing out to y'all?
Yeah, I got the big aha that I failed to give you a few case studies that we've been working on for 3 years. It's back on the list. Thank you.
Well, a big part of what we're looking at in 2025. So just to give a quick summary for what can seem big. The ultimate goal is that we have a library that we are leaving in perpetuity. To accomplish that, it's been funny. Everybody that I've talked to about what we're doing as the next step, I've started by saying we were so busy doing the work, and you saw that list of all of the demonstration projects. including you, Mark. You're on there. But we've been so busy doing the do that we have not had time to document what we've learned. And everybody that I've talked to have said, yeah, you and every other organization. So that is a big part of what's next. The interim step between where we are now and the library is to create, they may be 5 to 10,000 word resource documents that just have the who, what, when, where, who to contact. That if we go no further than that and the resources that we currently have, we've at least got the stuff written down. And so the budget that I shared with y'all for what we're looking at as phase two, is really just to create those documents, to interview the people that were involved, and to get it down in writing. It might not even be a narrative form, it might be an outline form. It just needs to be in there. So that's really what we're looking at as phase two. I'm sorry that Amy is not with us yet. I'm hoping that she'll join us soon. Amy had an idea. Amy Sample Ward and I were talking the other day. Amy is the CEO of N10, the nonprofit tech network, maybe, and a brilliant activist. And we were talking about how to pull phase two together, phase three together, and what's next. And especially being as fundraising is going to be a big part of this. And Amy's thought was, and I loved this, and I'm still not articulating it as clearly as she did, was that we find big groups like N10 that want to host that library so that it's not just at Creating the Future, which we've been talking about. We've been talking to folks in different statewide organizations, provincial organizations about hosting the library so that it's everywhere. But what she was talking about is getting some of those big ones together, and that becomes the application to funders to say, we've got 30 organizations, or those 30 organizations come together and say, we need this thing. And so I loved the collective enoughness in it. I loved the collective impact in it of it not being, we want to do this and we think it's good for the world. And we've got one or two partners and here's who they are. Instead, having those partners be the ones to say, we need this and we're all coming together and it's 20 of us, it's 30 of us. And so that's a pretty exciting approach to something that's going to be a little daunting. We need a whole lot, as those of you who saw our financials, and I shared with everybody the fact that last year we were excited that we hit the soft underbelly of almost $70,000 as an annual budget. Creating the Future has been run since the beginning on volunteers and stipend wages, and that has been, as many of you who have been here since the start, that has been for two reasons. One, it has gone so deeply against our values to go into the power dynamics of begging at the table for the scraps of funders. The second reason was very pragmatic from the start and continued to be. And that was, as a startup in the beginning, you get very little dollars. And we're not a food bank, we're not providing direct service, we're not helping homeless folks. We're a thought, we're an idea. And so a startup and an idea, we would have been spending our time chasing $5,000 grants. And we chose instead to do the work. And between earned income and the wonderful donor support that we get, that's really been the ethos. Now we need to step into grants because we need, if we're going to do this fast, if we're going to do this in the next couple of years, we need an infusion of cash. So it's a different approach than we've taken, but I love the fact that we can continue to uphold our values as we're doing so. So any other thoughts on what you read, what you looked at, what you saw?
Yeah, one of my thoughts, and I thought was really interesting, and is the idea of doing sort of the interviews now to gather the information, because I think it's really fascinating to have the reflection of not only what was implemented and what was demonstrated and experimented with at the time, but now having this look back at the process. I think it was really interesting to me to take that perspective instead of just saying, this is what we've done and that's great. Now you can say, this is what we've done and this is actually how it's been implemented and how people feel about it in real time. And I think that level of sort of historical data, which is both sort of qualitative and quantitative, is really what takes the, catalytic thinking from an idea to really a system and to something that can work. So I really like the way that this new phase is being implemented, and how it's going to be documented at this point. I really found that to be interesting and novel, and I think could be really effective. And to your point, Hildy, I love the concept of having a an organization host the library so that it is, or organizations host, so that it is accessible and it is something that others can put out there. Because obviously this is an idea that I think, it needs to have that fire stoked. It needs to reach as many people as it can. So I was really happy to hear you say that. Yeah, I'm excited about the next phases. I think they're being implemented in a really effective way.
I hope so. I hope so. Anyone else before we move on? Yeah, Carl.
It was good to see it systematically set out. In that way, I thought that was really good, and potentially sort of helps in terms of sort of what targeting, sort of what you want to prioritize in terms of gaps. But just to sort of emphasize what everyone else is saying, I mean, it's very little resource that's a very little formal, sorry, resource that has gone into sort of a sort of like producing the things that we've got, but also sort of looking at sort of the year last year. And then in turn, I mean, sorry to sort of, if this is, maybe more challenging for us, but I mean, it does highlight the scale of the task that we've got in terms of fundraising, in the sense that, I mean, it's multiples of our current turnover. And I mean, I guess that's a challenge both in terms of securing it, but also convincing funders who might look at what we're asking versus what our current budget is, and ask questions about whether or not we are able to deal with that increase in the level of resource. But I'm sure it's, it's in our wheelhouse. We can do it.
Yeah, we had a wonderful and energizing meeting towards the end of last year. John was part of that conversation. Just with several of the people in the room were career fundraisers, and my hesitancy, maybe not hesitancy is the right word, but my concern has been the same, Carl. To build out the entire library could cost as much as $1.5 million. If we're recording classes and producing, and I mean, we're talking video production, we're talking about all the things that we've done, pardon me, on our own over the past 10 years. If this is going to happen in any kind of time frame, it's going to have to hire people. And looking at, okay, you had a $70,000 budget. And now you need $1.5 million. The answer is no. And it was really inspiring to hear these career fundraisers say, yeah, no, we need to be thinking about it differently. And thinking about it through the lens of what is the budget really? Okay, so each of you is putting in $100,000 worth of salary and you're getting $4.27 instead. Okay, so the other $99,000 goes into the budget. It's real. It just wasn't cash. And so just starting to think about it in different ways, it was energizing to hear two career fundraisers say, I think this is doable. And we'll find out. The same way we have addressed everything since our inception, we'll find out. If it doesn't happen, we will have learned something, and that might be another demonstration project to describe. And Shantine, we can go through and see what the impact was. Yeah. Well, I'm excited. Who wants to know why the overhead is so high with our $4.20? I agree. 10% of that went to admin. Righty. Yeah, Mark.
I've got a quick question. You don't have to address it right now.
Yeah.
I'm getting a lot of questions from all over the place right now. How do we measure our impact in terms of outcomes? Because it's not metrics, it's not qualitative, quantitative, it's qualitative, it's anecdotal, it's it's story, and we're having trouble getting money for stories. So, like I said, you don't have to address this now, but I'd like that question to be addressed eventually. Thank you.
Yeah, we've had a bit of that conversation. I'm gonna do something. Just 1 second. Sorry, we've got the space heater going on in here, and I think it's time to turn it off. We have talked in the past at this board, and it was a long time ago. We were talking about indicators of success. And the overwhelming sentiment of the board at that time, and many of the people are still in this room, was why are we trying to metricize something that can't be metricized? And a big part of what we're doing with documenting what we've learned, is to address that question that people have. No, we're not going to give you numbers on impact. I can tell you how many people have attended classes. I can't tell you what they did with it. I can't give you fortunately for the work Kim has done and Justin has done and Angie has done and Mark, you have done. I know those stories will be included, but I don't know all of the stories, and I don't want to. You've heard how many times we have said that we'll know our mission is successful when people we've never met are asking these questions of other people we've never met. That's just the reality. So for us, we're just looking at reframing the question that people have, which is, are you being effective? And if what it takes is, here's 30 case studies, and you can learn from them what you want to learn from them, a big part of what we're fighting against in the work that we're doing is the demand that people metricize stuff that can't be metricized. If the ultimate goal of our work is a loving, humane, healthy planet, I can't do that. One of the things I've realized, and then we can move on, because Mark, you and I could talk about this for 4 days. One of the things I've realized in writing the book, and in particular, the section on just what we're talking about here, measurement, is that what's easy to measure is what's on the minus one side of the scale. It's easy to measure what's wrong. It's not easy to measure what's good. And so it what we do, what we don't want is really easy to measure. How many people are in poverty? How many people will be in poverty? How many people are homeless? The things we don't want are really easy to measure. The things we do want are love and humanity and equity, and those things are impossible to put a measurement on. So that was just a real aha for me, and I need to be writing more about that. So, Mr. Pollock.
I actually think this is a segue into that idea of obeying before, because I think, and Mark, in no way do I want to trivialize what you're experiencing, but what you're talking about, Hildy, and what I think those of us who tend to work within organizations that have these purpose-driven pieces is they lose their purpose-driven narrative, in a way, because it's co-opted by this metrics piece. I mean, we obey before. I mean, I work with organizations and they say, well, we can't state that as an outcome because we can't measure it. I'm like, you've already backed off of what you're trying to change in the world before we've even, like, we don't even allow ourselves to say it because it's like, well, that's too big, or, you know, you're too Pollyanna-ish, or, you know, how will we ever know that? And I'm like, well, you ask people, because you know who the best evaluators in the world are? People. When you ask them, you know, it's like, you know, we are the best barometers of hypocrisy that exist. And so, yeah, so I think actually that sort of cues up. I mean, I don't know exactly where you were going with or plan to go, Hildy, with that conversation, but I do think about how much change makers or aspirational change makers curtail themselves. And so then we do actually lose the narrative of aspiration and change because it becomes so transactional.
Very, very much so. Very much so. I hadn't really thought about it in terms of obeying in advance, but you're right. We comply with the systems. And in part, it's because, and it does lead directly into what we're going to talk about today. In part, it's because we know what's wrong, but we don't know what good looks like, and we don't know what it takes to get there. We don't have an alternative to go to. One of the things I kept observing after COVID was everybody kept saying we can't go back. And we went right back. And the reason we went right back is because we didn't have an alternative to go to. So we knew what we didn't want. I mean, it's a perfect example of that math line that I'm always using, that we knew what minus one looked like. We had no idea what it would take to get to zero and no idea what plus one would look like. And so we lived in what's wrong because we didn't know what good would look like. And it's why I thought today, talking about the importance of do not obey in advance, which is a brilliant statement, and it's a do not statement. So as we segue into that conversation, so thank you, Justin, for that bridge. One of the things that you all know that catalytic thinking is so rooted in brain science. It's rooted in the ways our brains work. And one of the interesting things about the way our brains work is our brains can't not. Our brains don't understand not. So when we say things like we want to eliminate poverty, what our brains actually do is they go to less than, not none. So, you know, the classic example of our brains can't not is the don't think of an elephant. If I say don't think of an elephant, you'll be thinking of an elephant for the next 10 years. We hang on to the thing we've said, and our brains don't do the negation. They don't opposite that. And so there's been some research out of Columbia University that I know of, and there's probably others, where they have looked at what does it look like when you talk about there will be no poverty. People imagine there will be less poverty. So when we say do not obey in advance, I don't know what to do. I don't know what obeying in advance might look like. I don't know how it might come up. I don't have the aha that, oh yeah, the same thing with measuring things that can't be measured is a form of obeying in advance, because it's not something that's part of our lexicon, and we don't not. So what I thought would be helpful today is to really start having the discussion about what does good look like? If we know bad looks like not obeying in advance, what does it actually mean? What do we do? What are we doing? And so I figured the best place to look at that is through the lens of catalytic thinking. So that is, as you noted, Justin, the perfect segue. So thank you to you, and thank you to Mark. As we are thinking about it, there are so many instances where this is going to come up. The immediate instance, obviously, is the fact that Congress came very close in the last session to passing what became known inside the circle as the nonprofit killer bill. For those of you who are not familiar with that, And especially if you're outside the US, you might not be, although we all were talking about it a whole lot, so you probably were going, okay, enough. This is an anti supposedly an anti-terrorist financing bill. So it is to prevent the money laundering that can go to terrorism. And within that bill is a clause that gives the appointed Secretary of the Treasury the unilateral ability to take away the tax exemption from any nonprofit that they deem is supporting terrorism. The Trump administration, or I should say, Trump himself, has said flat out that he is after nonprofits, he is going after nonprofits, and that many nonprofits have been against him, and he is going to do everything he can in his power to eliminate them. So we have a bill that was in the works before he was elected, that came very, very close to passing and may pass again, where with no due process, the Secretary of the Treasury can pull the tax exemption from any organization. And one of the things you've all seen in our newsletter that we keep beating the drum of is, if you think this isn't you, you are wrong. That while many of us are going to say, well, we don't support, we have nothing to do with international relations, we have nothing to do with anything that could be conceived as financing terrorism, and the list sort of goes on. The list could be, if you are a union that goes on strike and the administration determines that that's a terrorist activity. If you are a food bank that feeds refugees or illegal immigrants into the country where we're supposed to be getting rid of them, and now we're feeding them, there's so many different ways that this could be interpreted, and it's unilateral. And while yes, you can object afterwards and you can fight to get your tax exemption back, damage has been done. Your tax exemption's been pulled. Your community knows that you are on the terrorist watch list. I mean, just go on and on and on. So it feels very urgent in so many different ways that this sector know what it means to not obey in advance. Vu, I know that you've been sort of at the forefront of this as well. Did I capture it? Did I do okay? Anything you would add? Okay, we're gonna get nonverbal facial recognition from Vu today. I'm good.
Sorry, everyone. I'm
I'm
just
good.
no.
You're writing the book in your head. I'm good.
No, I appreciate it. I don't know. I'm kind of conflicted. I mean, one is that it's a really undemocratic threat. I mean, it's awful. We're basically learning from what Russia has been doing. It's silencing oppositions. It's pretty horrifying. And at the same time, I don't know. I mean, I would not support this, and I think we need to be fighting it. But I think it does kind of make us think about like the structures we have in the sector and what we need to do in preparation for it. Fighting it is one thing, but also we might need to have some more creative ways to think about how nonprofits are structured so that we are not as vulnerable to these types of attacks. So movements, for example, or like, it doesn't matter if they remove our tax status if we don't actually have any statuses to worry about.
I know when Robert Egger and Vu were together in the podcast, we talked about, okay, so if tax exemption goes away, what happens? So, but we don't need to talk about that right now, but I think it's really, really, really important. And I think it's part of why I was feeling like catalytic thinking might be a way to say, what do we do to make sure that we can continue to support our communities? So let's dive in. The very, very first question in catalytic thinking is, who will be impacted? So if we are talking about the kinds of things that could attack specifically nonprofit organizations. But I'm really thinking that there's going to be draconian crackdowns on just about all sorts of civil disobedience. If we're talking about not obeying in advance, who will be affected by that? Who will be affected by the work that we are talking about that currently nonprofits and other aid organizations are doing? Go.
So this is really just a fascinating topic for me. A little bit of ran it seems like random background, but now it just feels like everything always comes together in the way it should. When I before I was an employment attorney, I worked in national security, and one of the first things that I worked on when I was in law school was something we called the Terrorist Trial Report Card. And it was the Center on Law and Security that I worked for at NYU, which is now the Rice Center. And what we were doing was poring over documents, dockets, everything we could to understand at this point from basically 2001, where all of our politics, all of our policies on terrorism and what that meant changed with the Patriot Act and so forth, how that had panned out over time and impacted people. And what we had found is that for the vast majority of people who were accused of any kind of terroristic behavior, and that's a number of criminal codes that cover that type of behavior. The largest and most impactful charge was the material support charge, which is essentially providing support financially or otherwise for terrorist organizations. Because unfortunately, it was very simple to prove in most cases. You know, if you had ever sent a dollar to somebody who happened to one time post on an Al-Shabaab blog that they believed in it, you know, they could tie your behavior to a material support charge for terrorism. And with this bill that we're talking about now, I see direct parallels because unfortunately the simplest thing to do is to trace money and to make that money look like it is going to the wrong sources. And certainly if there's an absence of due process with respect to the either the elimination of nonprofit status and just saying, you know, well, you're not one of them, so too bad anymore. Or if it's, however it pans out, if it's a tax implications, et cetera, the impact is going to be massive because it's going to affect, of course, the nonprofits themselves, the people, the individuals who work for the nonprofits. I can tell you know, when we were looking at this data, we were seeing that, you know, the folks at the top were charged sometimes, but usually it was the folks at the bottom who didn't have any power, who were the ones being pulled in with these criminal charges because they didn't have a system of defense. They didn't have the ability to afford top attorneys. And I can tell you those New York prosecutors did not let anything slide. So, you know, the fallout from something of that nature for a bill that it wants to crush nonprofits. Again, yes, it certainly will affect the nonprofits. It will affect the people at the top. It will affect the employees, certainly, because if they're the ones making whatever action it is that's questionable, they will be the ones who face repercussions for it because it's just much easier to prove. I worked in this area myself. I know that we oftentimes had, as when I was prosecuting national security cases of this kind, we went after the people who we had the evidence for, and that is the people who are at the bottom. And then, of course, there's the who's benefiting from whatever the nonprofit's doing. So, if the nonprofit is pouring money into another organization because that's how they find the biggest impact, then is that organization now at risk because they can be seen as accepting material support from an organization that has been deemed to be terroristic in nature? So, it's a huge discussion, and it's just like I could talk endlessly on this because it occupied my life for so long. But I see this, you know, the threat from Trump is very real. I think that we have to acknowledge that this administration is not a joke. And I know I still have people telling me you're overreacting, and I'd say, no, I'm not. And so I think it's just the fallout could be so huge that we really have to look at it so holistically in terms of, yes, where you're taking money from, that is important to always vet, to always make sure that it's coming from the right sources and that you can say as best as you can, document as clearly as you can what those sources are, but then also where you're putting your money, because those people can get wrapped up in these things too. So, yeah, it's just, it's scary. It's a scary thing to think about.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about the recipients of service. Yeah. I also want to acknowledge that Robert Ballantyne is watching, so I know that you're commenting, Robert, and I'm watching your comments as well. Thank you. And anyone else who is watching and would like to comment, I'm just glad the system is working. Yeah, go ahead, Dimitri.
On the comment stream, each comment has a 200 character limit. Robert had a whole bunch of sequential comments because it hit that limit. Just want to point out, Twitter had a 280 character limit, and you'd have to do the same thing if you were in Twitter. So that is a limit set by YouTube. So just letting you know if you're in and doing that.
Thank you. Thank you for that. So we're talking about nonprofits themselves, obviously, will be affected. Their employees would be affected. And again, not just of this particular legislation, but when we're really talking about that whole concept of obeying with totalitarianism in advance, obeying with systems that go counter to what our purpose is in advance. Nonprofits, obviously, their employees, the people who accept support. Who else will be affected? I'm going to add donors to that list. Donors and funders.
And
I
just
don't
the
mean.
community, oh, sorry,
Go
the
ahead, Angie.
community more broadly that may, depending on what the work is, which community or what part of the community.
Right. Right.
It also affects other nonprofits, right? I mean, there's a chilling effect. When a nonprofit is targeted and it's successful, then their counterparts or even nonprofits that do something completely different will necessarily be chilled. This is, pretty much a fact. It's the same with any kind of speech. So if money is speech, this is greatly impactful on the community of nonprofits as well as the community at large.
Sure. Mark and then Carl.
Yeah, I beat you, Carl. My volunteers, if they're afraid of what I'm doing or what I'm going to do, or even thinking that I may be crossing the line somehow, huge impact, I think, there.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Carl.
We have a little bit of experience of this expression, the chilling effect, in the UK, where there was a piece of legislation passed that was about campaigning during election periods. This is about sort of 4 or 5 years ago. And our experience here, I think there's a couple of things I would draw is that, first of all, actually, some of the people who are strangely were perhaps more affected than most were trustees, were boards, because boards are already very risk averse, sort of generally speaking. And a lot of the change in behavior or potential sort of clamping down on activities was actually self-policing. So the sort of chilling effect that Shantan sort of talks about. So in some respects, whether the law passes or not is irrelevant. It's always the threat that the law is going to be passed, and that does the work. So in some respects, you have to do, that's the reality I sort of think you have to deal with. But then I guess the other thing to sort of think about is that, for every action has a reaction, to sort of like use the physics sort of term. And I mean, there are good things that come from episodes like this. And that is, I mean, it does prompt the sector to organize in ways that you might have thought were not possible before. It does change the attitudes of some funders, and it makes them sort of wake up a bit, and sort of smell the coffee, and sort of that can sort of be good. So there can be a reaction sort of there as well. I'm going to say one last thing, which, please don't hate me sort of all for sort of saying this, but sort of like, here you go. Is sort of one of the things that's affected is that does it sort of, is there a risk, I guess, with our response to something like this, which is we are right, everything we do is perfect, and because this person is so bad, they are the enemy, and we don't need to change. Because, this person is so clearly such a bad person, and I genuinely sort of think, from watching afar, the guy is a disaster. But I think we have to be really careful that we don't just sort of withdraw into we are perfect. And I think it would be a wasted opportunity if perhaps, as Vu may have been suggesting, it's not used as an opportunity to ask ourselves questions of, well, actually, are we getting anything wrong?
Welcome, Amy. It's good to see you. We are just really starting into the conversation. So your timing is good. We're asking as we're thinking about the overall do not obey in advance directive, and we're thinking about the coming years in terms of what we are facing, not just as a sector, but as a society, who will be affected by whether we obey in advance, whether we do not obey in advance. Donna noted on YouTube, Donna, I'm glad you're here. Thank you. State nonprofit centers, so state associations of nonprofits and community foundations. Mark and then Kim.
Yeah, quickly, I just realized that my marketing, media, advertising, and communications people are totally affected. What message are we going to go with? Are we going to bend that? Are we going to make that a little softer? Are we going to tweak it? Are we going to avoid things? Are we going to kowtow to the new whatever? Huge impact.
I was in conversation online the other day with somebody who said that they were a consultant. They said that they had just met with a client that was talking about scaling back their advocacy work in advance. It was the exact words, in advance of what might be coming, in fear of what might be potential retribution in whatever way. Kim.
So I was trying to think about how to phrase this, and I may not do it very eloquently,
That's
but
fine.
I think so these types of threats, changes in the States absolutely has effect just without like beyond the borders, right? So in Canada in particular, what I've seen politically happening in my province, I've told Hildy lots about what's happening here, is very Trump-like. And it's almost as he comes into or has been reelected and everything, I feel like it's going to swing even further because they're obeying in advance as well, right? Like they want to be in the good books and things. And then we will have a federal election coming up and our prime minister is stepping down already before the actual election. And the person that I hate to say it, like I know is going to get in is absolutely like Trump-like, not as obviously crazy. I don't know how else to put it. But just like those ideals are there. And I live in rural Alberta and very small town, and I see it all around me. And it's not because people are bad. They are very focused on one thing that they think this government can do for them. And that's their whole world. That's their whole perspective. And they don't have, every time I talk to someone, I realize I'm trying to put myself in their shoes and see like, why do they believe this? Like, why? And it's about them. They don't have this ability to step outside themselves and see the other effects that it could have. And so like I try to do education. Based on what I know about people and my own personal experiences with that person. But it is just, it's that Canada's like right on the cusp, I think, of being more Trump politically, and that's incredibly scary. So I think it affects beyond your borders into other not-for-profits. And I know we said other not-for-profits, but I don't know if we explored the breadth of that.
The thought of the chilling effect being outside the country is tremendous. Is tremendous. And how many of the resources that we all use are cross-border? So if the kinds of resources that we're looking at are suddenly shifting subtly, if the stuff that comes out of Board Source, if the stuff that comes out of other places that are cross-border is very subtly changing in language, changing in approach. I really had not thought about the cross, the international repercussions of it, Kim. Thank you. Who else? Yeah, Shantine.
Yeah, Kim's point is really well taken, and I think that one thing that we saw, because the parallels are so direct with early 2000s Patriot Act, how we reinstituted the terrorism laws back then, and how we sort of made them as malleable as needed to accomplish the mission, is that currently, or under this administration, the countries that the United States feels are safe countries to work with are sort of limited to a certain number of countries. And then there are other countries that the United States has deemed, by the whether it's DOJ or the Department of State, has deemed to be at risk, or countries that we don't want to work with. When I worked for Customs and Border Protection, that was certainly the case, right? We had countries where we watched a lot more closely where things were coming from and where things were going. And with the Trump administration, that list of suspect countries or people or players outside the United States can grow rather exponentially and without rationale. So it's really going to impact, I think, also how we are able to work with our, with counterparts in other countries. If we are if we have aid workers working in sections of Africa or Middle East, will that be deemed to be a risk that is not simply because a security risk on a micro level, but now is that country something that has been designated as a either a terrorist-sponsored country or whatever it's going to be? I mean, their language can change, and it has changed so much to make these designations fit the political agenda of the current of that administration. So I can certainly see things that we think are is very safe to do right now, right? To send money abroad to even Doctors Without Borders. I mean, really well-established not-for-profits that work in other places with high levels of conflict and security risk. That list can expand and really, really chill and have enough impact on the not-for-profits in the United States as well as abroad, and how they're able to interact across borders.
You're bringing up another thought that it came up during the initial conversation about what was a congressional bill and moves beyond that. As we're saying, whatever bill it's going to be, right now it's focused on terrorism. It's going to be something else. This is going to be whack-a-mole. This is absolutely going to be something's going to pop up that in terms of obeying in advance. Speaking of the chilling effect, I'm thinking about universities and universities where, Angie's, your home. Thinking about universities that teach Middle Eastern studies or teach whatever it is, environmental, if they decide that environmental is terrorism now, if I mean whatever it is, if you're teaching labor relations in universities, does that have a chilling effect on what's being taught? Especially nonprofit universities that deeply rely on tax exemption because their donations, we were laughing before at our budget. Their budget is not our budget. If you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in donations that could go away if you're deemed a quote terrorist organization or whatever you're deemed, whatever the blame label du jour is, I think universities is another big big potential problem, problem area of people who will be affected. And that's huge because that's not just the work that they're doing. And maybe an expert from the Middle Eastern Studies Department being on the news is taken down by being an expert. But if the entire university is at risk because they're, quote, teaching stuff that the administration doesn't like, do they start to obey in advance by saying, we're not going to be teaching it that way? We've seen so much happening in classrooms. In middle school and elementary school and high school classrooms, where you can't teach real history. And again, obeying in advance to say we don't want to be taken, we don't want our funding taken away at the state level because we think this might offend if we actually say that slavery existed. Those kinds of things in an educational setting are very, very scary to me. Kim is mentioning that again. It goes back across the border as well. Robert has mentioned on YouTube, humans are changing the world, but do not seem to have the tools to manage that change. Creating the future has the potential to help us to manage what seems to be unmanageable. It brings me to the next half of the question of who'll be affected. And I'm sure we're going to come up with others as well. The next half of that question is what would it take for those individuals to lead what comes next, to lead the approaches that we take? In my mind, we tend as nonprofits, as organizations, we are set up as individual organizations. So right there, we're set up as individual in the image of businesses. We are set up as individual organizations with individual tax exemptions and individual reporting to the IRS. We're seeing more movement work. We're seeing more mutual aid work that is outside of that, which is bringing causes together. But we are so used to being within our four walls. And we think that leads to our thinking we're alone. And I can't help but thinking about all of the people that we have just listed. We have listed nonprofits, both the ones who are targeted and the ones who stop doing their work the way it needs to be done because of that chilling effect. We're talking about their employees, the people who accept support from them, donors, funders, community members in general, volunteers, all of those people. What does it take to activate those individuals so that they are the ones leading the charge? And that's the second half of that first question. Who will be affected, and what would it take for them to be leading the charge and leading the direction that we take together? What needs to be in place for that? What do they need to know? What do they need to have?
One of the things that we were talking about, we've been talking about in the sort of nonprofit scholarly circles, especially l last year when Arnova went to Florida, is, and we did some webinars kind of talking about the actual policies in place and what they actually mean, or what we understand them to mean, not just assuming things about the policies that are in place. And we know, for example, there's been a lot of threats to, DEI and the curriculum issues that you were talking about earlier, but actually some of our interpretations are assuming a lot, or they're very cross states. And so the fear of just like that unknown kind of causes us to self-discipline. So having more knowledge and information about what actually is happening and what the actual policies are, and thinking about them in a larger context. And then in addition, having legal support available to consult. So you know kind of where the potential boundaries are, or not, so you can navigate them or step them overstep them deliberately, and have support available to you if you choose to do that.
You're talking about knowledge of the policies. When it comes to some of these groups, like volunteers, community members, there's to me the and with that is knowledge of the policies and how it will affect you. Shantine.
Yes, certainly. Backpacking off of what Angie said, legal support is essential to understand the limits of the policies. I think, furthermore, we unfortunately have had similar things like this threat in the United States repeatedly, right? And this harkens back to it was actually my law school thesis on COINTELPRO, which was an old 1950s through the 1970s FBI-led counterintelligence program that targeted subversives. In that, those days, it was communism and socialism, and I mean, I see that also being declared a threat now. But in any case, we can look back at sort of how these policies were implemented to see what the government did to destabilize movements that did at their core have an agenda that I think many of us would align with now. So, student movements that were intended to help not only inform other students, but lead the mission to help people understand that the threat, of communism and all of that wasn't really how it was being defined, and that there were other issues in the United States itself with inequality and racism and poverty, et cetera. What did the government do to destabilize those? Well, it disrupted those activities by infiltrating them. It discredited movement leaders, right? It aroused suspicion between parties that would, generally work together. It would promote, splits within those communities. Sometimes there would be, the demonstrations that they would have a, agent provocateur create some kind of disruption, and so it looked like the movement was violent when it really wasn't. And these are things that we've also seen in the past several years. So just understanding the means by which these powers can impact the forces of good, which is, I think, what we are, is really essential to identify those things, and then it can help us defend against them. Without having that knowledge and background, it leaves us very open to the influence of those forces and not understanding where they're coming from, and a lack of awareness about where these efforts may be coming from. So just, I think it does behoove nonprofit leaders to really understand, yes, that they need to have the courage to kind of carry forth their message, and it takes a level of stalwartness to do so, but then to understand where those threats can come from and how they can manifest is really essential. And I don't believe that in any way that, we're past this that dark time in history in the 50s and through 70s where these things happened. They can happen again. They have happened again. If you look at some of what happened during the peaceful marches that we had in the first administration and how, we had arrests that were made under very, very questionable circumstances led by federal forces that shouldn't have been there. I mean, there's just a lot of things to really worry about, but education of the in this regard, I think, is absolutely essential. Yeah, 1920s labor movements, Marx said, history repeats itself, so we can learn from that history.
Yeah, I mean we're looking at that with the student protests about Palestine. I mean everything that you noted there, discrediting, suspicion, accusations of creating violence when it's actually the government that's creating the violence. What else needs to be in place for all of those? I mean, basically what we listed here from nonprofits themselves, donors, funders, volunteers, boards of directors, community foundations, messaging people, advocacy work, aid workers, universities. What we're basically talking about is entire communities. The answer to who will be affected is anybody whose life is touched by a nonprofit, which is everybody every day. So if we're talking about everyone whose life is touched by a nonprofit, which is everybody every day, what does it take for them to be the ones that are leading the efforts? For them to be the ones that are gathering around and actually making the difference. Because there's a big difference between saying, no, really, it's not me, and an entire community coming together. What needs to be in place for that to happen? Kim, yeah.
excuse me. We've been talking a lot about structure of the not-for-profit system here and just how competition keeps us from competition for resources, competition for funding, whatever it is, keeps us from feeling like we can work together in a different way. I think that's it's I've started to see changes. I'm seeing it. It's not happening very quickly, but there's kind of catalysts in our community working to kind of change that traditional thinking of this is how a not-for-profit has to run, this is how the funders have to fund, and all of those things. So like there's stuff starting, but for people to be comfortable, they have to be comfortable with it. So they need to know why it needs to change and how it could change. And still, like, people are worried about losing jobs, losing supports, losing whatever. We have to be you have to be able to feel comfortable that what we do isn't going to be such a risk that and risk is another piece. Like my board, I had just had a special meeting with them over about something, and the risk is so prominent in their mind. Like they can't get past it's that brain. Even when I tried to ask the questions differently, they just couldn't get past it, right? So risk is it's so scary for people, and it can be really scary. And we also know that if we don't take risks sometimes, we just stay where we are. So yeah, that comfort and how do we explain to people that this could work in this way?
Yeah, and boards of directors tend to be more risk averse than the staff anyway because they're scared, because they're not in the day-to-day. They feel like they're in charge and they're not in charge. They don't understand what it means to be in charge. Yeah.
I like what you were saying, Kim. Hi, everyone. This is Amy Sample Ward. I feel really honored to get to talk with all of you and see some faces I know and faces I would love to know. Kim, what you're saying really sparked me because we've been talking about this at N10. And part of, I think, at least what we've been talking about is enabling support for larger community action is kind of the ability to organize without a trace, because part of what makes community members, community leaders, organizations vulnerable is that there are records of what you've done and who is on which list and who came to that event, right? And so, how do we help organizations extend organizational privileges like certain tools that allow you to do organizing work or whatever that maybe they have access to or can buy. So how do we help them feel comfortable making those accessible to folks who are in partnership or in relationship with them that aren't staff or maybe don't even have a nonprofit status themselves but are a mutual aid group within their service region or what have you. And then also to do that in ways where kind of setting those systems up to remove the trace, like a single button wipe, right? So that you can help folks feel like they have some level of confidence doing that good work or standing up or moving through the work that is to come, knowing that they're not creating like a data trail that will be used against them, right? Or against others in the community. And I can put it in a chat, but Tracy wrote this really great, helpful, thought-provoking article that kind of touches on some of these pieces too, around like what are in our technology systems that are maybe not good at this point, at this juncture.
Yeah, huge. Just tremendous. I know Justin had told us that he was going to be in and out a little bit, so just letting folks know. The more I'm thinking about the power, the things that we are afraid of, there's something in me that says the things that we are afraid of are how we will be perceived by all of the people on that list. So if let's use the example of the bill that was around last year. A, that bill's going to be back, but B, it's going to be something else. As you said, Shantine, after 2001, it was everything. It was, did you go to the farmer's market to get your fruit? Then you're obviously a communist and you're out of here, or a terrorist. There's something about we are afraid that our donors are going to say, oh my God, they're a terrorist, they're supporting terrorism. We're afraid that our funders are going to say that. We're afraid our volunteers are going to say that, that the community is going to say that we're going to be shunned. I mean, when I think about what are actually the things that we're afraid of how it's going to appear and be and affect all of the other people on that list. And what's sort of occurring to me, and I don't have a concrete thought about it, is what would it take for all of those people to be so knowledgeable ahead of time? So if we're not going to obey in advance, maybe prepare in advance. What does it take for all of those people to know what might be coming for us to push that button, Amy, and to say, okay, it's here. It's up to you guys. It can't be up to us because the d defending ourselves is the old I'm not a crook. What needs to be in place for that whole community to come together to say, yeah, no, we've got to figure this out. What do all of those people that are maybe not inside a nonprofit, because so many of the people that we all named are not inside nonprofits, they're the people who are going to be affected.
I have a comment. Just a quick comment about bullies. These are bullies. And I had posted an article to the chat link, and I can put it in the chat stream of they're political bullies. They are anti-vax bullies. They are just run down an entire list. And bullies don't negotiate. Bullies. And this is, I think, something to answer your question, Hildy, or at least one of the things I'm thinking about in relation to your question is that people need to understand that there is no, okay, we'll just meet them here on it. Because if you meet a bully here, then they go to the next step. The kind of the opening line in this article is that Neville Chamberlain, note to Carl there, thought that they had achieved peace in their time with Hitler by appeasing to Hitler, at one particular point. And there was no appeasing. Hitler was a bully. I mean, he was a monstrous bully, but he was still a bully in the way he behaved. And so he just continued. And I think maybe one of the things to arm oneself with is knowing that incremental, well, we'll just not do this. We'll not just do this. That it will mean there will be another not do this. At some point, you need to kind of set, draw the line and say, no, this is where we are. And I think being forearmed with that knowledge might be helpful for folks who have to deal with it.
That's just tremendous because that is a big piece of how the obeying in advance happens. It is incremental. We're going to just do less advocacy work. We're going to take our advocacy work that's here and we're going to scale it down by this. But we're still doing most of it. Yeah, I think that's tremendous. So what is what there's sort of two threads in my mind as we're thinking about this. I'm thinking about the thread of what nonprofits themselves can do. But that's further down the line. The first is in my mind of what would it take for the people who are going to be affected to lead the charge on this, to lead whatever direction we as a society take. We've talked about they need to have knowledge. They need to have knowledge about the way that the attacks, whatever you want to call them, might come. They need to be knowledgeable about the policies and how they will affect the normal average humans. I think that's really what we're talking about here, is that the ultimate impact of what we do as social change and nonprofit organizations, the ultimate impact isn't for us. The ultimate impact is for the people who are going to be affected. So there's a big piece of what would it take for those people who are going to be affected? What do they need to have? What do they need to know? What do they need to believe? And maybe what do they need to believe is a big one. In order to counter this or to be strong in the face of it. Shantine.
Yeah, that's, I think what do they need to believe is so essential because one of the things I think we've really seen, particularly with the election, but of course elsewhere, is that there is a hesitancy or plain resistance for people to be able to access that part of them that empathizes unless something happens to them directly or they feel that something will challenge them directly. It is very hard for many people to sit back and abstractly observe and say, I need to stand up because otherwise these other people will be impacted. I know I won't be, but they're at risk. And so I'm going to put myself out there, put my neck out there, and do the work that needs to be done to protect them, the other. And, to the contrary, we see frequently folks saying, well, I thought that this immigration law was going to impact other people, but now it's impacting my neighbor or my uncle or my son, whatever it happens to be, right? And now that it's in their family, it's in their circle, they feel impacted in a new way that makes them want to take action or, at the very least, regret the decisions they may have made that made them complicit in that action in the first place. So I think conveying to the public, and this is such a challenge, right? This is the challenge in my view, conveying to other people that just because they are not individually targeted or they don't feel they are at any given time doesn't mean that there won't be an incremental encroachment upon their rights as well. And making that a reality in some way, I think, is the essential method we can use to get people to act. Unfortunately, I certainly don't have an answer right now to tell you how do we do this effectively because there's so much noise out there that it really is until someone's directly impacted that they can't see how their behavior has made them complicit in a system that will eventually lead to their own demise, if you will, to be quite dramatic about it. But I think that's sometimes a very apropos word. So bringing it to them in a realistic way of saying, look, you might feel that this cramping down on nonprofits, whatever, is not going to impact you, and therefore you're not going to take up a mantle and you're not going to get involved. But let me tell you how this will impact you in a real way. That might motivate people. But again, I would love to hear other people's thoughts on how we can do this because it feels sometimes really hopeless to me sometimes of really conveying that to people. And I don't ever want to fall into hopelessness, but I'm just constantly trying to figure out how we can do that as a society and on an individual level as well. And I find it very challenging.
The thought that's occurring to me as you're talking, and I'm really, really, really glad you brought that up. Several things. First, the and then they came for me, obviously, is popping for many of us. There's something in there, and several of us have touched on it, that has nothing to do with the immediate threat. And yet is about, and there's so many efforts out there to do this. And it, okay, he'll say a complete sentence. People need to see how nonprofits affect their lives, period. There have been efforts for, I've only been in this sector for 30 something years. There have been efforts for all of those years to say, nonprofits are important. Look how they affect your lives. We are such a big part of the economy. All of this sort of proving ourselves in a world that somehow thinks that business is more important than taking care of people. I think in this particular case, that in general, understanding how nonprofits affect our day-to-day lives is important is almost a pre important precursor to understanding what would happen if they were gone. So if my local food bank is feeding refugees from a country that we don't like and don't want to talk about as refugees, and we decide that they are supporting terrorism, having the community come around and say, this food bank affects my life in the following, I don't get food from them, but it affects my life. And I think that there's something, I'm probably not being very articulate about it, but there's something there about understanding the degree to which community benefit organizations actually benefit each of our lives. I don't know that people can take action until they feel it personally, and so many of us have been saying that. John.
Thank you. It's two different things come to my mind, and I kind of stay quiet on purpose. This conversation is kind of triggering in many ways for me because I grew up in a community where we had a group that was characterized as terrorists, the Black Panther Party. And it was exterminate, literally. I recognize what Dimitri said is kind in a way. These are not just bullies. These are terrorists in a very real sense of the word. And we somehow think they'll stop. They won't. I've been here 70 years and I've seen it. So, as we're having this conversation, the first thing that comes to my mind is it's not a matter of just fixing it. And I think that was what Vu was saying a little earlier. I think we need to recognize this is just a fight. This is almost classically good and evil. And we need to realize that evil doesn't go away. It's not going to go away. So I think with that in mind, we need to, and I think you started touching on this a little bit, we need to gird ourselves for battle. And we need to recognize that it's a ongoing thing. It's not going to, it's just becoming more obvious and evident, maybe. But I was sitting at my mother's house when they bombed the MOVE enclave in West Philadelphia and let a neighborhood burn to the ground. So this is not a threat. This is a reality. We need to recognize we live in a dangerous situation, period. And that the fight for freedom is not going to end. It's always a fight. It always has been and always will be. And I think as I listen to us, we have to recognize that when we say, what can people do? I think first thing is recognize that we're really in a fight and that this isn't just political. It's way beyond political. And that it's very real. I just think the reason a lot of people they just close, if you close your eyes, you don't see it. So as long as I keep my eyes closed, I don't realize people were murdered in their beds in the 1970s and we did nothing. Now people are murdered on our streets and we do nothing. So as we have this conversation, even as quote nonprofits, we need to recognize you got to choose what side you're on. It's not, you're either on one side or the other. You can act like you're, not, but the reality is if you're not with us, then you're against us. It's really that simple. So I think as we talk about this, on the one hand, I think we need to recognize it's not just a matter of educating people. It's really a matter of equipping people for battle, for this struggle that's in front of us. Because as I'm hearing this conversation, I'm thinking I could have had this exact same conversation 50 years ago. The bridge and Selma, all of those things are just demonstrations of the thing we're talking about. And so I think maybe part of what we have to do is recognize that as citizens, as owners of our communities, that we need to come into this with a different, I'm not in a conciliatory mood. I don't want to settle. I want to win. Because if I don't, then I'm going to be the victim. It's either victor or victim. There's not really coexistence. Where, I think we need to be real careful. Because I think as nonprofits, sometimes, we're all about good and this and that, but good is what you fight for. It's why I went into the military. People always ask me, as a black man in America, why in the world would you go into the United States military? I said, because I believe in freedom. And that's what we're talking about, is fighting for our freedom. And so we have to be aware that fight didn't end when I got out of the military, and it won't end probably ever, but it definitely won't end in the next 4 years or 5 years. So we have to go at this from a very serious confrontation. I think we don't like being confrontational. We don't like being confrontational. And people take advantage of that. Because if you back down, then, so I just wanted to say that.
Thank you, John. Thank you. It is it creates such context, and you're absolutely right. It's part of why I keep thinking that this can't just be nonprofits, that this is so emblematic of something that is comprehensively against our best interest as humans. And it's why I keep asking, what does it take for all of the people on that list to come together? And this can't be seen as a nonprofit thing. The do not obey in advance doesn't give me as a citizen, what do I do? What do I do? And I really truly believe that there are so many people who are sitting back saying, this is horrible and I'm afraid and I don't know what to do. And that's when the and then they came for me piece steps in. Steps in. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Amy, you had posted something about the paradox of tolerance. Can you talk about what that is?
Sure. Simply put, it is basically saying that if you tolerate everything, then you will lose because the thing you have to be intolerant about is those who are intolerant. Otherwise, we will all be gone. And I think about that in these conversations where sometimes the idea of the beautiful, equitable world we want to create and doing work in values-based ways confuses that this is, to John's point, a fight. We have to say, we will not tolerate this, right? And I think that is just as John said, much, much better than me. Like, that is a conflict internally for individual humans, but also for organizations. We're like, we don't fight. Like, we believe in a peaceful, beautiful world. But those who don't want us to get there will not stop at anything to ensure we don't get there, right? And so what does it look like to resist that? And the paradox of tolerance is just kind of like a name for that catch 22 of, if you tolerate everything, well then like we're the ones that get eliminated in the game.
Yeah, thank you for that. There's that whole nonprofit nice thing. We have to be nice to everybody, and there's lines in the sand, and I think that we're facing one. And so, in part, when we talk about and unfortunately, we're running out of time. But as we start to talk about, and I think this is a conversation worth continuing, whether it is us as a board or us as a community, I'm almost feeling like we move this beyond a board conversation, and we start having these conversations, hosting these conversations. I think it is a role that. It's why I wanted to talk about it today as we were talking about stepping into 2025. I think that in addition to what we had already planned, which we will definitely be doing, I think that one of the roles that we have always taken on is convening conversation. And I think that having this conversation throughout the sector is something that we can take on as creating the future. Because we've got a framework that is all about questions, and what everybody's got right now is questions. I wish I could count the number of times people in this conversation in these squares said, "I don't know, how do we?" And well, we have to come to some proactive words rather than what not to do. Do not obey in advance, unfortunately, doesn't tell me anything. But what to do? What shall we do? What does standing our ground look like? What is our ground? Do we know what our ground is as individual organizations? This may be the time for organizations to come to, what are my values? What are our values? We talk about honesty and integrity and respect and what are our real values when it comes to authoritarian takeover of community? So I think that I'm really sensing that this is a conversation to be continued, and to come to some real active things that people can do. What are things that people can actually do? So, as we are getting ready, and Carl, I do want to definitely hear what you're thinking. As we are getting ready to close out here, if you all took any notes during our conversation, if you're thinking back to what is standing out to you just from this initial diving into this conversation that we had, and Carl, tell us what you're thinking.
Well, then, by way of summing up, I think what's happening to you in the US is not unusual.
No.
I think it echoes what's happening in other parts of the world, including here in the UK. It just so happens, though, that certainly at least one of the people that you have got on the wrong side of this, I mean, is richer than anyone else and has access to a media network that no one else does, and so on. But I guess my provocation to you, to us all, is, as uncomfortable as it is to acknowledge it, we have to start asking ourselves, why did people vote for this stuff? Yeah. What is it that they're unhappy about, and what is it that we are not doing as a nonprofit sector that means, or what is it that we are doing as a nonprofit sector that means that people are voting for something that is fundamentally opposed to everything that we believe in terms of sort of our values? And I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think we have to be careful that we don't just end up talking to each other and reaffirming our existing biases and so on. And we have to have some uncomfortable conversations, it sort of strikes me, about what is it that's sort of going wrong here. And I guess we've got to try and find a way of just trying to listen to people that we might not agree with. There's a guy in the US I follow. I don't know if any of you have heard of him. He's called Noah Smith. He's an economist. He writes an interesting blog called No Opinion, and he's writing stuff that makes me uncomfortable. He refers to the nonprofit sector as the groups, capital T, capital G, and he's a progressive person, but he thinks that we've gone wrong in terms of what we do. So I think we've got to make sure that we diagnose the problem first before we can try and sort of think about sort of what the solution is. So that's my first thought. And then my second thought is that I had a conversation with someone the other day. They're working in a sort of a field that philanthropy is sort of supporting around alternatives to meat and so on. And she's very insistent that their approach is about field building. And she kept using this expression all the time, field building. We've got to build the field. And again, no surprise to anyone here, but thinking about what is it that funders do, what is it that infrastructure bodies do, that's about trying not to just build individual organizations, but it's about building the links between them. That's about building the capability of individuals as they sort of move around. That's doing some of the stuff Vu has sort of talked about before, which is when you look at some of those right of center philanthropies that fund the same organizations or whatever, or the same issue for 25 years, and they don't spend all their time asking for monitoring and evaluation reports and so on. So my reflection is I go back to something I said earlier in the conversation. This is a crisis, okay? We mustn't waste it.
Thank you. Absolutely. So let's take a moment, deep breath in, and especially that breath out, which we tend to be holding our breath these days and not breathing out. So I strongly recommend breathing out at least every once in a while. What is standing out to you from our conversation today? I'll share one of the things that's standing out to me is that this is a beginning of a conversation that this is a conversation that we need to have. I think we are at a crisis point. I think we're at a crisis point where so much of what we have done at Creating the Future since our inception in 2011, so what is that going on 14 years? Has been when we look at structures like a board, like employee policies, et cetera, we have consistently taken the what if nothing existed, what would we build? And I really think we are at this point in the nonprofit world. I think that there is a definite need to rethink this entire system. And that can't happen overnight. And that's not, it may be part of the long-term plan of resistance, but that has to be in the mix is certainly occurring to me. What thoughts are occurring to you all? Yeah, Shantine.
First, I just want to say what an incredible conversation this has been. I fully agree that it's just the beginning, and it actually really heartens me to have this conversation, knowing that it could be carried forward to a much larger groups, because it's so essential to start organizing in this way. This is an organization, right? This right here, having this conversation matters. I think it's going to take immense courage on behalf of people and organizations going forward. And that's something that, folks might already have, but if they don't, we've got to give them the tools to develop it. And along those same lines, one thing that I keep thinking about is how do we get people to act when they are so consumed by the inequities in their own life that it's really hard for them to say, okay, I know I can't pay my rent, I can't really afford my groceries, my childcare is too expensive, but now you're asking me to organize and you're asking me to march with you and take time off work or do whatever it is or come to this meeting. We have to find ways as individuals and also to encourage nonprofits and other organizations to facilitate that in some way. So whether that's changing the outreach so that we are giving people, better childcare, whatever it happens to be that they need individually and personally so that they can become an activist and they can organize and feel like they have the ability to do so. So they're not so focused on what is happening in their own day-to-day that's oppressing them. And I think that is it's a massive, right? But it's a massive undertaking to change that. But it's really essential because John said this is a fight. This Carl said this is a crisis. It's not theoretical, it's real. We've seen it before, so we can't be blind to that, but we have to be able to encourage people not just ideologically to get involved, but also encourage them by giving them the support and the foundations that they need so that they can activate themselves in a means that isn't just fighting for survival for their day-to-day. So fascinating conversation. I just appreciate being with you all and hearing everyone's perspectives. It's a tremendous group, and I think there's so much knowledge and information that we can share to with others and like-minded or not, and continue this conversation. So just again, thank you for letting me be a part of it. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Anyone else? What's standing out to you from our conversation today? Yeah, Dimitri.
I think many, many people feel this way. I think that the ability to network and communicate and let people know that other people feel this way, I think that that's really, really important. And that, everyone at this virtual table has their own networks, has their own people that they talk to. I think that's the only way to move forward on this is to show that this is a movement, show that this is a shared belief, show that this is because that will take people who may be, as Shantini were noting, I got 8 minutes between my life and everything that's going on. What could I possibly do? Well, if I know that my neighbor feels the same way that I do, or my friend feels the same way I do, maybe they can watch my kids for 20 minutes. It is part of what a community does. And so that's kind of what I'm taking away from this is the universality, whatever, of what is happening here and the importance of us to be as a nation, as a community, as a neighborhood, of saying no to bullies.
What else? One of the things that has been occurring to me, I mean, the realm within which many of us work is the nonprofit realm. It's where we have influence. To me, what is really standing out is that this cannot just be nonprofit. That the most important thing every organization can do is to start involving their community in the different conversation. That's not because the only times frequently we go out to community and we talk about it as going out to community, as if the community is not part of us. It's really a rethinking of are we part of community? Is community part of us? Or are we here and we go out to community when we need something from them? I think right now what we're talking about is the building of community and the importance of understanding that this cannot just be us. This has to be our com the communities, us as part of community. And I was talking before about the fact that we're built like businesses. We're not built to think we're part of something else. We're built to beat our chests and say how great we are. And we go out to you when we want something from you. And what we happen to be selling isn't deodorant. What we happen to be selling is something else that we want your donations for. But I think that there's something really powerful at this moment that we need to be looking at our primary job, whether we are giving out food, whether we are dealing with literacy, whether we're dealing with technology, whatever our job is building community first and foremost. There's something There's something in this in me that's just feeling that this is so much bigger, and we've got to stop talking about it as just nonprofit.
Well, and just to build on that and connecting to what others have said, I think nonprofit, a lot of them are part of the problem, right? They're why we're in part why we're here. And so we do need to move beyond that and yeah, the multiple solutions, Amy, as you had mentioned. But I guess, yeah, I think even the way we talk about nonprofits, to Vu's point earlier, is assuming a lot of things about nonprofits that perhaps are counter to what's actually been operating as nonprofits have been operating to sustain these systems that have caused us to be where we are now.
And that from someone who teaches in the nonprofit world. Thank you. Thank you especially for that. Donna's noting coming together as like-hearted people rather than like-minded people. So everybody can feel welcome to take part. I think that's really, really big. Really big. Robert noted there needs to be a new narrative, a new vision about the future that humans are creating. One that becomes shared globally, not just the USA, and in all languages. People want it and people have to want it. Other thoughts before we wrap up here? I want to just say thank you to all of you for bringing your hearts into this conversation because this has really been, it's been important, and it is a start. It is a start. I really truly believe this conversation has to, we have to keep this going. What does it look like to fight rather than not obey? What does it look like to resist en masse because the vast majority of this country does not want the direction that we're going? What does it take to create that? What does it take to make that the reality, and to stop, for lack of a better word, to stop the evil that is being put upon us. And if you know, in the old words, in terms of nonprofits and why we exist, which is for benefiting our communities and making the world better, if not us, who? You know, the if not us, who? If not now, when? That's got to be our mantra. That's got to be our mantra. So thank you all. I'm really, really, really grateful that you're all part of our work. And thank you. I'll see you guys soon.
Thank you all. It was great to see you.
Bye.